Coming up next, HealthLink on Air. Tonight, we'll talk about the options for cancer pain relief.
A major contributor to the experience of pain in cancer is stress and a lot of the helplessness that can accompany a cancer diagnosis and the subsequent treatments, and those things can often amplify the pain experience.
Plus, the evolving importance of the health professions.
When you take the aging population and the greater insured population, who will run the x-rays and who's going to do the laboratory test?
And the new president-elect of the American Medical Association looks at current issues in healthcare.
The problems for using electronic health record are myriad. It requires a lot of investment of time, money, energy to get up and running.
And that's all coming up right after the news. This is Upstate Medical University's HealthLink on Air, your weekly dose of information about health and medical issues affecting Central New Yorkers from the region's only academic medical center. I'm your host, Linda Cohen. On tonight's show, the new AMA president weighs in on the issues facing medicine today. Plus, we'll get a bird's eye view of the allied health professions and how they've changed to meet the growing needs of healthcare today. But first, cancer pain can wreak havoc on patients as they fight the disease. What are the most effective pain relief options available today? The majority of people with cancer will experience pain at some time or another, and the pain can result from the cancer itself or sometimes from the cancer's treatment. In addition, some people who have been cured of their cancer may continue to suffer from pain. We'll hear with more on this and how to find pain relief is Dr. Brendan McGinn, assistant professor in the Department of Anesthesiology and the director of the Comprehensive Pain Management Center at Upstate Medical University's Cancer Center. Welcome, Dr. McGinn. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
So let's begin by helping us understand a little bit more about what causes cancer pain.
Well, cancer pain has multiple causes, and these can range from tumors physically compressing structures such as muscle, bone, skin, nerves themselves, internal organs, and as you alluded to, also treatments for cancer such as chemotherapy, radiation therapy, surgeries, they can also be a cause of pain. And also a major contributor to the experience of pain in cancer is stress and a lot of the helplessness that can accompany a cancer diagnosis and the subsequent treatments, and those things can often amplify the pain experience for these patients.
So what you're saying is you've got like three components you've mentioned. So first of all, the actual tumor or something that's obstructing some normal bodily function can actually cause pain by impinging on nerves or muscles or all of that. The treatments themselves obviously can cause some kind of pain, whether they be surgical intervention or some kind of chemotherapy. But then you're also saying that the psychic pain, so to speak, or the expectation or the fear can
absolutely
also lead to pain as
yes,
well.
Absolutely.
So those are all functions. So what kinds of symptoms generally do you see when people have cancer pain?
So this very much depends on the cause of the pain, but it can range from joint muscle pain, abdominal aches, to burning neuropathies, numbness, tingling, associated pain in the hands and feet, and it's really anything in between. Cancer pain is really, it's acute and chronic pain in the setting or context of cancer, and it can manifest in just about any way one can think of.
So does it also depend a little bit about the stage that you're in terms of the disease, the stage, how much it's metastasized or how much it's spread, and also perhaps the location?
Absolutely,
all
yeah.
of those things.
Absolutely, yeah. cancer can affect pretty much any part of the human body, and in so doing, pain can have multiple locations, very systemic pain, very localized in certain areas, and certainly this depends on if it's the initial diagnosis well into progression of the disease or very much so during and after the treatments themselves.
But as we talked about in the first, when we first started talking, there's also this whole idea of perception of pain that plays a role. So does some of this, is some of it impacted by the person's own threshold for pain? And do we all have different thresholds for pain?
That's absolutely, yes. You know, oftentimes patients, a lot of cancer patients may have already been affected by chronic pain in general. Patients that are going through very traumatic periods in their lives in the context of their cancer diagnosis and treatments can have a much lower threshold for pain. We mentioned sort of the fear of pain coinciding with disease progression and what that might mean for them long term certainly has a lot to do with the pain experience overall.
So how important is it to treat? I mean, how important is timing in treating cancer? You often hear things like get ahead of the pain. I mean, what does that mean? And in general, how important is timing?
It's very important. So when any sort of chronic pain begins to manifest, addressing it early certainly helps to get a handle on it, can oftentimes help prevent very rapid increases in severity, can help prevent some of the large swings in pain severity that can occur as disease progressions evolve or progress, or and you know, conversely, getting behind pain is often a very difficult hole to dig out of. So when pain is inadequately addressed, it's definitely can be a challenge in terms of getting a patient comfortable in terms of the amount you have to employ that might not have been needed if you had addressed pain at an earlier stage.
Right. So the earlier you get it, the less maybe medication or intervention you might have to undertake.
Absolutely.
So that's crucial. And also in terms of just generally keeping people comfortable,
yes,
I would think.
Yes, absolutely.
So, well, obviously one way to remove pain if it's a function of the treatments would be to stop the treatments, obviously. But in many cases, you can't do that. So what... Let's start with medications to start with in terms of what you would use to treat cancer pain. And are they based on the severity of the pain symptoms? I mean, what you choose, is it based on severity?
Absolutely. You know, even the World Health Organization actually has a ladder for sort of addressing cancer pain,
really?
Itself, and it has to do with severity. And, you know, there's a multitude of medications that are used to treat, you know, generalized acute and chronic pain itself, and all these can sort of be applied to cancer pain in the same way, you know, just like somebody would be experiencing low back pain or diffuse arthritis, a lot of the medications used to treat that can be used in cancer pain.
So let's start with something like if you have mild pain or mild to moderate pain, what's in your bag of tricks, so to speak? What's in your doctor's bag,
sure,
at that point?
Oftentimes, you know, people look beyond some of the very basic over-the-counter medications, things like Tylenol and ibuprofen, a lot of the NSAIDs. These are fantastic medications that, you know, otherwise people take to treat aches and pains, but those can be great in treating joint muscle pain that's associated with cancer. This can be in the context of tumor involvement or even post-surgical pain. There's medications that somebody might be taking for diabetes, or sometimes we think of sciatica, shooting leg pain that can be from nerves being pinched in the back. People that take those for those chronic pain states, you can use those medications to treat chemotherapy-induced numbness and tingling, neuropathies, we call them. So there's a lot of overlap here.
Yeah, with pain in general, you're saying. Mm-hmm. I know. But so so these are most of the things you started with are over the counter, mm-hmm, kinds of things. But how about when the pain really, mm-hmm, starts to ramp up,
sure,
or the nature of the pain is more severe? Right. What do you turn to then?
Yeah, we you know, employ medications called opioids, and these are medications such as morphine and its derivatives, medications that are similar to it. And these are absolutely excellent at treating severe pain, especially cancer pain. And this can be pain involving deep organs, bony pain, pain from mucosa breakdown that occurs with bone marrow transplants. A lot of pain that is the most severe is can be very well treated with sort of early and aggressive employment of these medications.
So things like their hydrocodone or OxyContin, those are the things that people know by name.
Exactly. Those are
the things. Yes. If you're just joining us, you're listening to HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here along with pain management specialist Dr. Brendan McGinn. We're talking about cancer pain and how to treat it. How about this neuropathic pain? That's something you alluded to before. That's burning, tingling, and that can be, is it the nerve endings? I mean, what's happening there?
So, yes, it's actually when there's damage to the nerves themselves, and that can be from chemotherapy or physical damage from tumors or
impinging on them.
Yeah, and post-surgical pain. And so when nerves themselves are damaged, it's different than, say, muscle or bony soreness. It can be oftentimes described as a burning or tingling or electric-type pain. And we employ medications that are different from your standard, over-the-counter medications like Tylenol or ibuprofen. These are medications that can range from things that are used for seizures or things that are used for depression.
I saw that. Actually, I was noticing that this was kind of surprising to me as a layperson, that antidepressants can help with neuropathic pain and anticonvulsants, as you just alluded to, as well. So even something like prednisone, like a corticosteroid, can help.
Yep. Yeah. And, these medications historically have been used for those purposes for seizure or depression, but in different varying doses. And, over time, it's been shown that these are also help with chronic pain, especially neuropathic pain.
I want to get to some of the potential side effects of all these things, because I know that each one of them, even the over-the-counter drugs, carry some of those. But just in general, can you make a statement about some of the other therapies that you found to be helpful, the kind of ancillary therapies, whether it be something like acupuncture, massage? What's been your experience with that?
Certainly. So, as an interventionalist, I also treat a lot of chronic pain conditions with, various injections in the spine, in the joints or muscles, and all of these can be employed in cancer pain as well.
Things like nerve blocks.
So, I mean, examples are in patients with metastases to bones in the back. You can inject things like epidural steroids. Nerves can be damaged, those nerves can subsequently be blocked with injections. And these can be in a leg or an arm, but these can also be, deep inside the abdomen themselves. Sometimes these treatments are very transient, but in the combination with medications, they can help to contribute to patient comfort. And oftentimes these are best employed during times of acute pain exacerbations. But you mentioned there's the complementary therapies, and these can range from meditation and acupuncture and to aggressive psychological support that focuses on patients' overall pain experience.
Or even their fear of death, I would think.
Absolutely, absolutely. And these are crucial therapies, and they're oftentimes underutilized. And, some of the most beneficial, especially in the context of patients feeling like they don't have control of their situation. And like you say, the stress and the fear that can come from all of this.
So why is it that sometimes people don't get adequate treatment for cancer pain? What do you think leads to that?
So oftentimes pain control can take a backseat to treatment, certainly in some of the earlier stages when we talk about sort of getting ahead of pain, sometimes with, initial diagnoses and initiating treatment, there can be sort of a focus on that can, make pain management and sort of addressing that secondary. But there's also some of the medications that are prescribed, like we talked about these morphine medications, there are stigmas associated with those medications, and patients may be hesitant to use those because of that. But, these are in actuality one of the few indications for chronic usage of these medications is in the treatment of cancer pain. It's one of the best uses for these, and where we see some of the best benefits. And like any medication, opioids do have side effects, and that can be from constipation and itching, hormonal imbalances, but these are all very easily treatable.
How about the issue of addiction? Do people? Sure. I mean, I know people are often afraid to start using some of these narcotics and opioids because on the doctor's side, afraid that the patient may become addicted and the patient may be being afraid. Mm-hmm. Is there any reality to that? Or generally, should you use them regardless?
Sure. No, and absolutely you should. And there is a, you know, that there is are issues with that, you know, sort of currently in the pain community, but in certainly in cancer pain, there should really be no hesitancy in employing these.
I actually saw something that said that recent evidence suggested that good control of pain symptoms actually helps people live longer.
Absolutely.
Has that been your experience
Absolutely.
As well?
And whether or not that is, you know, a sort of placebo effect or just reducing the body's stress response, but you certainly do see that more often than not.
In the little bit of time we have left, what do you see happening in the future, if anything, or even more importantly, what would you like people to know, patients to know in facing cancer pain?
Sure. So, well, cancer pain is a major part of the cancer experience. It should be addressed early. It should be treated just as aggressively as the cancer itself. It's an expected and normal condition of cancer, and its severity oftentimes has no relationship to how a disease is evolving or progressing. And it's, you know, it's not just about medications. Treating it should be a multimodal approach. And that can include injections and interventions and the complementary therapies we discussed. And, you know, ironically, in this day and age, people are living through cancers that were once thought to not be survivable. And these patients, you know, may carry with them a lifetime of chronic pain that was the result of their prior cancer or their treatments, and even though their disease might be in remission. So it's important to treat chronic pain caused by cancer beyond the cancer itself as long as it exists.
And really, so early, get it early, and be aggressive about
absolutely,
the treatment.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much. My guest has been Dr. Brendan McGinn. He's assistant professor in the Department of Anesthesiology and the director of the Comprehensive Pain Management Center at Upstate Medical University's Cancer Center. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to HealthLink on Air. Next up, the president-elect of the AMA weighs in on the issues facing medicine today. This is Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen here with you. Well, the past two decades have seen a great many changes in medicine and in healthcare delivery in this country, with the growth and development of a variety of robust and varied healthcare professions. Here with a firsthand view of all these developments is Dr. Hugh Bonner. He's the retiring dean of Upstate Medical University's College of Health Professions. Welcome. Thanks for coming in, Dr. Bonner.
Thank you, Linda.
So you have been the dean since when?
1995. I came in August 1995.
So about 20 years then, yeah. you've been sitting in that chair.
Right.
And you've watched all of these changes take place. Tell us about this seems to have been an unprecedented growth nationwide in the programs to educate a variety of health professionals. Who are these people? What areas are we talking about?
Well, the areas that are growing, I think, the most are the mid-level practitioners. For example, the doctor of physical therapy students now graduate and are able to address the needs of patients directly. They don't have to go through two or three doctors before they're referred. They provide a great deal of help. The physician assistants have been a huge growth. And the practitioners that we produce take many of their classes with the med students so that they get the same kinds of background and understanding. I think anyone that has the direct care of patients, respiratory therapists, so many people with diseases of the lungs and the cardiovascular system, radiation therapists, so many treatments are now being for cancer. Include radiation treatments, and these are the individuals that provide that. So those types of professions are growing to meet the demands of the country.
So what are the driving forces that are pushing this growth? I mean, you've alluded to some, but what seems to be driving the force? I mean, is it the growth in population, or are there fewer medical personnel, or have there been fewer medical personnel to address these needs? Tell us about that.
Well, in the last decade, we had a drop in resources being provided for the training of and the education of health professionals. That has slowly changed a bit and improved. So we're now able to recruit students to come into the field. Over the years, we've had essentially 90% of our students stay in the program. They graduate when they come in. We do a very careful job of screening them and ensuring that they are interested in going into the field. All of our graduates get jobs in their professions. They pass the state and national exams. They're in huge demand because they are so well educated. We can provide the most cost-effective health care at the least cost to the public. So we're a great resource.
Clearly you are, but clearly there's been a great demand for these new professions or these additional professions. But what do you think? Is it population growth, or is it just the fact that we're living longer, the baby boomers? What seems to be the underlying driving force here?
Well, I'd say that the two major factors are the increase in the Medicare population. Between 2000 and 2030, we're halfway there, by the way, we will double the population of the Medicare, of those 65 and older. So we will go from essentially 35 million to 70 million people. That population also has a large number of individuals with chronic conditions, such as cardiovascular disease, obesity, diabetes, these types of chronic conditions that are very debilitating. Just to give you an idea, Linda, of the number, of that population, 82% of the Medicare population, which would be about 54 million people in the United States, have one chronic condition, and that would account for at least eight trips to their physician or healthcare provider. Within that population, there's also about 14 million people or 22% of that population that have five or more chronic conditions. So you can see that their demand is going to be huge.
It's exponential.
It is. And the demand for the professionals to be able to get to meet their needs when they need it. You can't go from one doctor to another doctor to another doctor. You have to come in and be treated by a team. And the professionals will be able to take care of the person's needs for those conditions. So I think that's a major condition. I think a second area of expansion will be the Affordable Care Act. In 2013, we had approximately 40 million people who were uninsured. And according to the Harvard Business Journal, that cost about $1,700 a year to take care of those individuals.
Per person.
So that's about $70 billion money that would come into the system. Between 2013 and 2014, with the initiation of the Affordable Care Act, about 10 million of those individuals came off of the uninsured ranks. So they now have insurance. So that those premiums are available to take care of some of the needs of these patients. And we expect that to grow. So when you take the aging population and the greater insured population, there are going to be a large number of individuals that are going to have to come into the system. And who can take care of them better? Who will run the x-rays? And who's going to do the laboratory tests? And, there's a large population or a large portion of all medical decisions are based on those laboratory tests.
They're critical.
X-rays as well.
Yeah. So. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Dr. Hugh Bonner. He's the retiring dean of Upstate's College of Health Professions. We're talking about the changes that he's witnessed in these fields over the last few decades. So obviously the demand is growing. The need is there. What currently are the existing workforce challenges that you see?
Well, the biggest challenge we have is getting enough individuals out into the field. We cannot possibly meet the demands as it is today. With the expansion of the aging population, those with chronic conditions, as well as the increased number of uninsured people who are now going to have insurance, hopefully in the near future, we're going to be swamped. At the same time, we are losing the existing population of practitioners. They, too, are part of that aging population. Just to give you one example, Linda, and it's not part of our group, but the registered nurses in the United States in 2020, 4 years from now, 5 years from now, 60% of that population will have reached retirement age. What are we going to do?
The trained professionals, the well-trained professionals, are reaching retirement age, as are all of many of their patients needing increased help. And so you're really, I guess, the resources is the problem looking for more resources to train the people, or that you're literally looking for people to be trained?
No, actually, for example, we had somewhere in the vicinity of 1,600 applicants for the 150-some positions we have. So we have a very strong group of students wanting to get into the program. We're lacking the number of faculty that we can
faculty
find.
Faculty shortages.
Finding faculty is very difficult. We also have trouble with clinical sites as more and more demands are being placed on the clinical systems. They don't have time to train students into the clinics. And you can't prepare, you can't give the high quality education to our students if they cannot get the help from the clinical placements. Additionally, although there is quite a bit of money and we spend more money on healthcare than the 10 other nations in the world, a lot of those resources stay in places that don't help us in the education of health professionals. Some of that money needs to be, those resources need to be redirected into the educational system.
What fields have shown the most growth in your tenure?
By far the biggest increase in numbers of applicants and so forth has been physical therapy. We've moved to the doctor of physical therapy to address some of the educational needs of a therapist coming into the field.
Explain that a little bit more. Why did physical therapy move to encouraging people to go on to a doctorate? What does that afford them?
Well, primarily, it gives them the educational background so that they understand the literature and they can compare the patient who comes in. They know from they can be able to assess the needs and diagnose what the patient needs to have based on what's been done in the literature before, and that takes a great deal of education just to get that type of a background. They also need to know which types of apparatus and which types of treatment would be best to help a patient. Also, with direct access of the patient who can come in directly to see a physical therapist, for example, the weekend warrior, what we like to call them, the people who are playing tap football in the backyard with the
right.
family and come in with a bad sprain of their ankle or knee or something, or a person at work coming in with a low back injury. They have to be able to really figure out what it is that has caused this problem, know when to refer the individual to another practitioner.
So they become more than technicians in this case. They become diagnosticians and basically try to treat the entire patient and recognize when they need to go elsewhere.
Exactly. And they need to be looking at the whole patient. So they will be looking at the injury, for example, of the weekend warrior. But they will be looking at their cardiovascular
status
and all that. And so forth. They'll be looking at the condition of the skin. They'll be looking at various items that could lead them to to refer them to another practitioner.
In the little bit of time we have left, in your wide bird's eye view of the last 20 years and where we're going, where do you think we're headed? If you had a crystal ball, where will we be 20 years from now?
I think you'll be having a lot more of the highly educated professionals taking over the initial treatments of patients as they come in, and knowing when to refer patients to a specialist and so forth, because otherwise we will not be able to address the healthcare needs of America.
As they're growing, you mean, as they continue to grow?
Yes.
Well, thank you so much. Very informative. My guest has been Dr. Hugh Bonner. I wish you all the best, by the way, in your retirement.
Thank you.
The retiring Dean of Upstate Medical University's College of Health Professions. Thanks once again. I'm Linda Cohen. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
Hi, I'm happier and healthier psychologist Dr. Rich O'Neill with this week's checkup from the neck up, betting with 19-1 odds and two fun facts. Well, dear listeners, as some of you may know from watching my checkup from the neck up on YouTube, I have worn a bicycle helmet sometimes when I'm taping in the studio, like today. Why do I wear a helmet when I'm recording? Simple. I bike to work most days, and because in my usual sanctimonious, healthier-than-thou, exercise-fanatic fashion, I'm advertising for fitness, showing that exercising can fit into our lives and be fun too. But neither of those is probably a good enough reason for you to wear a bicycle helmet to work, especially if you don't ride in. But come to think of it, if you've been trying to exercise more, that might be a way to get started. Wear a helmet to the office, and when people ask you why you're wearing it, just to keep admitting how weird you are, you'd have to start riding. What do you think about that idea? And when you do, how about this fun fact number one reason for putting on the little plastic protection? Bet you didn't know that 95% of all bicycle fatalities happen to people not wearing a helmet. That's 19-1 that we and our kids will live happier and healthier if we do. One other thing. Bicycle safety experts say that a great way to stay safe is to make ourselves as visible as possible with bright colors and flashing lights, and ride imagining that we're invisible, that drivers still can't see us, so we give them a wide margin of safety. The invisible man wearing a bicycle helmet. Pretty cool image, isn't it? Like that old Invisible Man movie special effect, where for some reason he put on sunglasses and we could see him moving around doing sneaky stuff. Bet the drivers would see us. Anyway, listen, 19-1 odds will be around to watch more movies if we use the helmet, bright clothes, flashing lights, while we're sneaking around preventing heart disease. Yep, fun fact number two. Did you know that we can prevent up to 80% of heart disease? That's right, 80% by changing what we do, like by eating healthier, quitting smoking, and exercising. So, while we're all out there pedaling invisibly, wearing our plastic noodle protectors, let's imagine all anybody can see is our hearts pumping strong through our clean, clear blood vessels. And then the neurosurgeons and cardiac surgeons will never see us on the operating table. I'm Dr. Rich, Invisible Man O'Neill. Thanks for listening.
Next, how the allied health professions have changed to meet the growing needs of healthcare today. You're listening to HealthLink on Air. This is Upstate's HealthLink on Air, Linda Cohen along with you. In this rapidly changing healthcare environment, one that is attempting to curb the rising costs of our healthcare system, physicians face some tough obstacles. These include the increased costs of operating a practice, time-consuming regulatory burdens, increasing challenges in reimbursement by insurance companies, and preserving the time-honored doctor-patient relationship in this new environment, just to name a few. We'll hear with some insight into these challenges and hopefully some answers is Dr. Andrew Gurman. He's the president-elect of the American Medical Association, and he is also an orthopedic hand surgeon in private practice in Altoona, Pennsylvania. Dr. Gurman is joining us by phone from his office. Welcome, Dr. Gurman.
Good morning. It's nice to be here.
Yes, thank you so much. So the pressures on doctors are growing in this new healthcare environment, and things have certainly changed quite a bit since you were in medical school right here at Upstate Medical University. Isn't that correct?
Absolutely. Even the name has changed.
Yeah. So let's talk about some of the things, some of these issues, and potentially what the AMA's stance on them are. First, let's start with the very big sea change that's taken place probably within the last decade, but much more so in the last 5 years or so, is what's been the effect on the mandated use of electronic medical record systems on physicians?
Yeah, that's a big subject, and I have to give a disclaimer to start with. I'm a dinosaur. I don't have an electronic health record.
Oh, wow. That's a very interesting perspective then.
Yeah, and I guess I should start with explaining why. You know, a couple of years ago, I knew that I would be moving towards the president-elect position in the AMA. Still had to be elected, but was hoping that that would happen. I am now 63 years old. I'm in private practice, and the economics of doing it simply didn't make any sense.
Mm-hmm.
So for me personally, I made the decision that even with all of the subsidies and all of the rest of it, that even forgetting the loss of productivity and all of the other bad things that go with it, that from a purely economic perspective, it made absolutely no sense for me to do this.
Right, and that's, I think, going to the heart of, I think, what I would like to talk about. Is this a major burden, or in what way has this become a major burden for those physicians out there?
Yeah, I'll get to that in a second.
Sure.
The other half of my disclaimer is that as a very subspecialized practice, I only do wrist and hand. There's actually very little of the benefits that one can accrue from an electronic health record that would apply to my practice.
Okay.
So we'll hopefully circle back to those benefits in a minute.
Okay.
The problems for using an electronic health record are myriad. There are some good things there, but it requires a lot of investment of time, money, energy, personnel, whatever, to get up and running. There are over 400 different medical records, electronic health records, available for purchase. None of them talk to one another.
Right.
So there are lots of frustrations involved with that. There is data security to deal with. There are hardware and software issues. There are updates. There's, you know, like any time you get a new computer for anything, magnified a lot because you have privacy requirements. You have very real concerns about missing things and whatever. The loss of productivity for most physicians is about 30%.
Mm-hmm.
That is either made up in working 30% harder, and we hear a lot from physicians who are writing, it's 10 o'clock at night, I'm still in the office finishing up my charts when I stopped seeing patients 3 or 4 hours ago. So there are lifestyle satisfaction issues that go along with electronic health records. There are some good sides. There are alerts and prompts about things that might be missed in other ways. There are some modules dealing with prescriptions that are very helpful with drug-drug interactions, medication renewals, vaccine alerts, things like that. So there are some helpful parts of it. But the fact is that electronic health records have really intruded on the doctor-patient relationship.
Mm-hmm.
You know, most of us went to medical school because we like taking care of patients. You know, when you think of it, it's an incredibly intimate act for someone to come and say, care for me.
Yes, absolutely.
And to open themselves up body and soul. It's a tremendous privilege to interact with people that way. And unfortunately, what happens now, and I see this when I go to my doctor for a physical, is that I'm talking to his back for a good portion of the encounter, and he turns around, does what he has to do, and he turns around and he's typing again. You know, that's not an intimate relationship, and it's not always a satisfying relationship.
No, I strongly agree with that. Things that I've read are that with electronic medical records, there's this, instead of reducing the time, it doesn't save time, it adds to the amount of time the physician must spend. They have to add staff, it decreases productivity, and as you said, it can also decrease job satisfaction. And some people, critics have suggested that doctors have become data clerks in terms of just, you know, being able to check all the boxes. But let me go on to some other issues. How about something like all the regulatory issues that are now facing doctors? We have the Health Information Protection Act, the HIPAA Act, and OSHA and things like meaningful use. How are those affecting your members?
Well, OSHA and HIPAA are the law of the land. They've been the law of the land for a while, and we simply learned to adapt to them. HIPAA has some very good things in it regarding patient privacy and patient expectations that their information will be treated securely. So we make an effort to comply with not only the letter of the law, but the spirit of the law. Meaningful use is a problem.
Why don't you help us understand exactly what that is for our listeners?
Yeah, we were talking about electronic health records a moment ago. You know, we surveyed with the RAND, the AMA surveyed with the RAND Corporation, did a large study of physicians in all sorts of different practices, and 100% of us hate our electronic health records. 87% of us don't want to go back to paper because we realize the benefits of the record. But when we face challenges like meaningful use, which is regulation that says you must hit these certain
benchmarks,
data points, benchmarks, whatever, in order to qualify for meaningful use, we sit here knowing that actually has no meaning to quality of care or to the kind of practice that we do. For example, in hand surgery, there are no benchmarks for meaningful use. There are no quality measures specific for hand surgery, so I'm asking patients about smoking, I'm asking about whether they had a pneumococcal vaccine, whether they had a flu vaccine. Perhaps in the past we asked, have you had a mammogram for females? You know, these are important health questions, but they're not why you go to see a hand surgeon.
Right, they're out of the realm of your particular expertise.
Exactly right.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on air. I'm Linda Cohen here along with Dr. Andrew Gurman, the president-elect of the American Medical Association. We're talking about the issues facing physicians today, some of the struggles and obstacles and challenges. Getting back to this idea of quality measurements, I mean, I want to kind of have a broad overview of what's happening in medicine. Doctors are being asked to do more in terms of all of this paperwork and all this so-called busy work, and it adds to a lot of burnout and a sense of dissatisfaction. And as you have so well said, there is this potential for a dissolution of the doctor-patient relationship or some limitations of it. But how are we attempting today? The government, with trying to bend the cost curve, is trying to look at different ways of reimbursing doctors. At one point, and up until very recently, we were being paid on the basis of what you do. There's a fee for service. And now insurance companies and the government are looking at a different way, and that has to do with quality. Help us understand that.
Sure. Well, the AMA has been involved with this on all sorts of levels, developing best practices, helping docs try to navigate through all of this. There is always opportunity for improvement to increase quality. What's being looked at in alternative payment measures is, is to pay, let's say, for an episode of care or for an illness. So, for example, If a patient has congestive heart failure, the payment bundle will go either to the physician managing the care or the hospital or some combination of both to say, we're not going to pay test by test. We are going to come up with a figure that we think is a reasonable cost for treatment of this. And we're going to pass that on to the physician or the hospital and let you guys decide what's the most efficient way to manage this.
Well, how will that actually affect the patient, though?
Well, the AMA is very involved in protecting the patient in this, because what we don't want is we don't want there to become an opportunity where denial of care or withholding of care becomes a financial incentive for people treating. So what we are doing is trying to provide physicians with tools to manage things. For example, high blood pressure. We are working with physicians and with some practices to develop best practice methods for treating high blood pressure, to make sure that people stay on their medications, to make sure that they self-monitor, so that if there are payments for episode of care or for disease, people will get better, will do it more efficiently, and everybody wins.
So the idea is to try to emphasize outcomes and quality of outcomes as opposed to being paid for everything you do.
Exactly right.
As a physician. So the idea is there's a perverse incentive for doctors to do more. Sometimes that's the suggestion, when it's not necessarily going to help the quality of outcome, whereas here they're trying to focus more on the quality. But I guess my question was, is there, as you mentioned, the potential then to perhaps undertreat?
Well, there is, and that's why it's important that a group like the AMA be involved in establishing best practices and helping people understand what are the benchmarks that we need to reach in order to assure that we are treating people appropriately.
I don't want to run out of time. There's so much we could talk about, but I wanted to ask you how you think all of these challenges that we've just gone over but not only are affecting current physicians, but our new crop of physicians coming up. I mean, it's been said that we're running out or we're going to have a decrease in the number of primary care physicians as a result of the current system. And what are you seeing, or what are you, as you look into your crystal ball, as to what's going to happen going forward?
Well, what's going to happen going forward is that there will be an increased reliance on team-based care. It is very important that physicians be the leaders of those teams, because we are the ones with the training, expertise, and experience to do that. But a lot of the care that is provided will be provided by other people practicing within their scope of licensure and experience to the maximum of their capabilities. As far as physicians going into primary care, that's very complex, and I don't know if we have time to go through all of it. But medical students are coming out of schools with huge amounts of debt, and they're making career choices based on their ability to repay that debt. There are lots of ways that we can address that. And the AMA is very involved in these kind of workforce issues, including loan forgiveness, and we have a whole initiative on accelerating change in medical education. That we really didn't even get a chance to talk to today. But the fact is that if you could change medical education so that somebody went through medical school in 3 years rather than 4 years, that would potentially cut their debt by 25% or more and might make their choice to go into primary care much easier.
That's a very interesting idea. Well, I thank you so much for sharing all of your insights on all of these very important issues and spending some time with us. And hopefully we will not see a dramatic shortage of primary care physicians will threaten the foundation of our healthcare system. And some of these ideas you've just floated sound very, very interesting and hopeful. Thank you so very much for your time. My guest has been Dr. Andrew Gurman. He's an orthopedist and the president-elect of the American Medical Association. I'm Linda Cohen. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. And now, Deirdre Nealon, editor of Upstate Medical University's literary and visual arts journal, The Healing Muse, with this week's selection.
Thank you, Linda. The hospital is like a corporation or a tribe. It has its own rules and rhythms within which its citizens and workers follow sometimes unconsciously. Weekends are often quieter, fewer staff on hand. In his poem, Making Rounds, physician Gaetan Scrow from Pittsburgh gently reminds his fellow practitioners to pay more attention to what is happening when they visit a patient. Making Rounds. With the hospital on holiday, our rounds were slack. All morning we drifted down narrow hallways, establishing loose perimeters around our patients' beds. Beside our recent amputee, the student assumed a steady cadence, a measured recitation approximating chant. The resident played conductor, his chin angled upwards, attending every word. One intern untangled the blind cord, while the other replayed a phone call that wounded the night before. A surgeon unwrapped and inspected the missing extremity wordlessly. Amid our distraction, three young women in navy windsuits slipped unannounced, their sneakered footsteps light as ninjas, with glittering pom-poms sheathed beneath their arms. Without interruption, the one with the warmest smile handed a homemade card to our patient, then bowed and exited before he broke into tears.
Thank you for joining us for HealthLink On Air, brought to you each week by Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. Join us again next week when we get an update on bariatric surgery today. Plus, that nagging headache, what could it be and how best to treat it? And how some of the next crop of doctors are being inspired to return to practice in the country. If you'd like to listen again to tonight's show, you can find a podcast of it on our website. That's HealthLinkOnAir, that's all one word, .org. And to keep up with all the goings on at Upstate, you can find us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Or check out the What's Up at Upstate blog at upstate.edu/whatsup. HealthLink On Air is directed by Amber Smith and produced by Steve Marks, with sound engineers John Miller and Gerard Roy. I'm Linda Cohen. Thanks for listening.